Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's program will feature two conversations on the topic of the Internet, privacy, and security. The Internet is arguably the most disruptive technology of the last 20 years, impacting nearly every aspect of life for the 2.7 billion people who have access. However, despite this growth, approximately 4.2 billion people lack access to the Internet, and a consensus has not been reached on issues of privacy, security, and government surveillance. This program was recorded before a live audience at our Global Philanthropy Forum.
My name's Tom Khalil. I'm the Deputy Director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And we have a fantastic panel this evening to talk about the disruptive power of the Internet. So the five panelists that we have are Alvaro Bedoya, who's the Executive Director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. He's an expert on digital privacy issues, including big data and cybersecurity, and has also served as chief counsel to the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law to its chairman, Senator Al Franken. We also have Takundu Chikunzo, who is the co-founder of Neolab Technology, which is a startup working to bring free internet access throughout Zimbabwe. He is also co-founder of Neo Effect, which is a social startup working towards the empowerment of underprivileged youth through IT literacy. Jeremy Malcolm is a senior global policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where he fights for balanced IP laws and policies for open innovation and internet users. He recently led the launch of the Manila Principles on Intermediary Liability, a roadmap for the global community to protect online freedom of expression and innovation. Julia Stash is the newly appointed president of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, one of the nation's largest philanthropies. Before her work for the foundation, she served as chief of staff for Chicago's mayor, Richard M. Daley, and the city's housing commissioner, leading an affordable housing initiative and a plan to transform Chicago's public housing. And Darren Walker is the 10th president of the Ford Foundation and a true leader in the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors, focusing on global social justice issues, including human rights, urban development, and free expression. This evening, we're going to be talking about the transformative impact that the internet is having on our economy and our society, both here and abroad. And as opposed to a lot of panels that either take a techno-utopian or a dystopian view, either everything's going to get better and there's nothing we need to do, or things are really bad and they're only going to get worse, I think we have a number of techno-realist participants who are going to talk not only about what some of the opportunities are, what some of the potential benefits of the internet are, but what are some of the real challenges that we face in areas like privacy and surveillance and free speech? So in terms of, you know, leveraging the disruptive power of the internet, we're going to start off and talk a little bit about what are some of the potential benefits of the internet revolution. So Julia, I know that the MacArthur Foundation has done a lot of work on digital media and learning, so I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the ways in which you see the internet provides the opportunity to transform teaching and learning.
So thank you so much for this opportunity. I want to tell you that the first thing that I am not going to say is how old I am. And I'm going to tell you why that's relevant. It's because however old I am, there are too many people who are my age that actually say, what's the big deal here? I actually learned just fine myself. And so I think that there are plenty of people my age who see all this happening but don't actually really get the power that says it isn't just about the few people who actually learned a lot in the past. It's about how can you have all the people learn everything they need to realize their full human potential. So I think that, even though I know that there's some disagreement to this, I think that I would like to suggest that in this room tonight, we stipulate the transformative power of the internet for learning. And as a matter of fact, what we can say is that learning experiences and learning environments are immeasurably enriched by connectivity and the ability to share and the ability to iterate amongst folks and the ability not to only learn within the hallowed surround of the classroom. When you think about simulations and you think about game design and you think about gameplay and you think about inquiry-based learning supported by stages of knowledge acquisition, I think we can stipulate that the disruptive power of the internet in learning is undeniable. But I think that the interesting thing is to segue from that positive comment to something that is relevant but much more controversial. And that is the power of the internet and digital technologies to generate information about individual students and the ability then to share that data. Now, this is good because you can see when young people are struggling with the mastery of a core subject. And you can actually make learning more visible through such things as digital badges. But the question is, how do you find the right balance between privacy and control and access to the rich array of learning experiences and assets on the internet? I think at the core of this is, how can we ensure that the internet is a trusted environment for learning? Because keep in mind that when privacy and safety are the number one driving imperatives, we absolutely limit the ability to design innovative, customized interventions for young people. It's a classic conundrum. Students want to use the internet and digital technologies. They're motivated to do it. But what they don't want is that the data that is generated by that be used for either categorizing or for discriminatory purposes. They want to showcase their successes, but they also don't want to lose control over how they are viewed and how they are valued. Now, parents, of course, want schools to provide the kind of experiences and learning so that their kids can absolutely be the best that they can. But they also don't want that relationship between a student and a machine to undermine their own parental authority. So I think at the core of this is a really urgent need to identify new models of privacy. And so I just, in two sentences, I want to commend you to the Aspen Institute's report on learning in the internet. The name of it is The Learner at the Center of the Networked World. And so the key there, aspeninstitute.org, the key there is really, how do you bring the commercial entities, the parent advocates, the philanthropies, the former FCC commissioners, and the and school personnel and library personnel all around the table, each with their different perspectives, to say, how can we work to make sure that the learner is equipped and supported to function within the context of all the learning that can take place in the school and outside of it? And so I think philanthropy has a special purpose, and to make sure that these kind of tables are set where the people with different goals and perspectives can actually come together around a knotty problem like that.
Right. One of the things that we want to do in this session is also talk about some of the risks of the internet revolution. And Alvaro, I'm wondering if you could talk about not only some of the major challenges associated with privacy, but the disproportionate impact that the lack of privacy can have on vulnerable communities.
Sure, and the fact is that over and over again, surveillance and a lack of privacy does hurt certain communities more than others. And because of that, I think we need to think about privacy as a civil rights issue. And so let me give you two reasons for that, and one just kind of came out this month. So the main reason we're talking about surveillance right now is because we recently learned, and not so recently learned, that since 2006, all of our phone calls were being logged by NSA. And what just came out, though, is that since 1993, all of the international calls in the United States had been logged. This is 13 years before everyone's calls were logged. And this was basically the pilot program for that broader NSA collection. It was the same legal rationale. It was, in many cases, the same modes of collection. And if you take a step back and think, who makes international calls in the United States? Immigrants. Who are they calling? Their friends and family. And so the single largest domestic surveillance program in our country's history was beta tested on immigrants. One point. Second point, looking at history. A lot of folks in this audience know that Martin Luther King was probably the most prominent victim of domestic surveillance in our history at the hands of J. Edgar Hoover. What a lot of folks don't see, though, is that that's just one piece of a much bigger puzzle. Because time and time again, the groups that we now admire and venerate were basically treated like criminals by the authorities and the laws of their day. So civil rights activists, LGBT service members, runaway slaves on the Underground Railroad. We now see them as heroes, but back then the law said they were doing something illegal. It was illegal to be gay in the military. It was illegal to be black and to march in the streets of Selma. It was legal to own someone and illegal for them to run away. And so as we build this world where we can track even more things, we need to think about whether we're building a world without underground railroads. And we need to think about whether we're building a world where weak and unpopular people cannot dissent because powerful people think that they're doing wrong. So I very much think that we need to look seriously at the disproportionate impact of surveillance and the lack of privacy, and that it's a civil rights issue.
So, Dara, I know that you have been arguing for the philanthropic community to get more involved in these issues. And so if foundations and civil society are not active and don't have a seat at the table and aren't shaping these decisions, what are the things that you're most worried about? What's the potential downside?
Well, in some ways, building what Julie said about the sector and the fact that philanthropy, the leadership of philanthropy, would certainly not be labeled digital natives. And I think it is a problem because if you are working on poverty or education, or in the case of the Ford Foundation, social justice, the internet is a battleground. The internet is not, the internet is agnostic about how it's actually used. And like the two faces of the Roman god Janus, it depends on where you stand, what you see. You can see evil and destruction, and you can see beauty and free expression. And what determines what you see is all about the rules of the road, the rules of engagement for being on the internet, and the policy that shapes, monitors, manages. And so what we in philanthropy find ourselves, quite frankly, is caught flat-footed because we don't understand this technology stuff. And I'm generalizing. I think there are certainly some foundations and some sectors in philanthropy that do. But for the most part, if you go and talk to any large foundation president, and I can only speak for the sector I know, which are larger foundations, you're not going to have a conversation with someone who's really interested in this issue. And that's a shame because we don't have much time to save the internet. And there have been some important victories, most recently with net neutrality, but there is so much more to do, and there is domestically, globally, real questions around policy. And so I just ask our colleagues in philanthropy to really recognize the importance of this from wherever you sit, and don't look at it and think of it, as one person said to me, well, we don't wire libraries. We don't. And it was like a 1990s statement about wiring libraries. And it was dumbfounding that a major foundation president actually thinks that if you're a foundation and someone says, let's talk about working on technology, that what you should want to talk about is wiring libraries.
Right. But what's an example? You know, we talked about net neutrality, but what's an example of something that could go either way?
Let's just look at, so we work on racial justice at the Ford Foundation.
Right.
So on the one hand, what happened in Ferguson was horrific. But in 1965, Dr. King gave a famous talk, and in the South, bureaus of major networks decided they weren't going to carry because it was too controversial, and they didn't. And so people in the South didn't see, and some Southern cities didn't see his speech. Well, in Ferguson, the amazing thing was the moment, at every moment, we had granular evidence of what was going on the ground
right.
because of technology. Mm-hmm. Now, that's good.
Right.
Let's look at the bad side, racial justice. The surveillance that goes on of particular communities that turn out to be communities of particular color and particular class is endemic. And Alvaro just spoke of it from the perspective of civil rights, but we have a regime and a scheme that allows discriminatory practices, whether it be in lending, whether it be in criminal justice, in education, that perpetuate the same inequalities that we have had in our analog world, now in our digital world, are just recreating themselves online. And so I'm simply saying, again, it depends on
right.
where you sit.
Right, okay, thanks.
Can I just add one tiny
yeah,
comment
absolutely.
To that? I actually think the notion of just being recreated online is not a powerful enough statement. I think actually what's being created online has a much more algorithmic nature to it. It has a much more automated nature to it, which I think is even scarier for its potential discriminatory power and to isolate people from opportunity. So I think we have more to be scared about now as we cede power to automated sorting that is possible with the internet.
Mm-hmm. Alvaro, is that something that the public interest community is looking at, the increasing fraction of decisions that are being made automatically using machine learning?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it touches on what Darren and Julia both said. Let's look at lending and credit, right? And so for years and years, your credit score has been determined on, you know, how many credit cards do you have? How many loans do you have? Do you pay them on time? And increasingly, it's turning on things like, do you pay your phone bill on time? Do you pay your rent on time? And increasingly, in smaller instances of growing, it turns on things like, how many friends do you have on Facebook? Do you buy bird seed? Do you have those little sliders that go underneath your furniture so they don't scratch the wood? Now, this cuts lots of different ways, right? Because there are going to be a lot of low-income people out there who
right.
are thin or no file, but you better believe they pay their rent on time, and they pay their phone bill on time. And so those folks might get access to credit that they couldn't before. But then there's two questions. The first is, what kind of credit do they get? And in a world where credit isn't just, you know, what determines the kind of money, that determines the amount of money you get, but also is used for employment checks, is it better to have a poor credit score rather than no credit score? First question. Second question, you know, I was born in Peru, came here when I was 5, and where I grew up, in the city, and we had, you know, stone or tile floors. I had no idea that these little furniture sliders existed. Right? And you better believe we didn't buy bird seed, right? So pigeons would come eat. And so we have no idea how a lot of these fringe mechanisms of evaluating credit are going to evaluate people. And the last thing I'll say is that That's a disparate impact argument I just made. What I can tell you categorically exists today are lists of people sold by data brokers to creditors that say things like, this is a list of low English proficiency Latinos who you should target for a payday loan. That is a real list that exists in this world and was previously available for purchase before a woman named Pam Dixon got it taken down. There are lists of people with Alzheimer's, people with diabetes, people who have sexually transmitted diseases, and these lists are up for sale right now, and you better believe that they aren't just used for marketing. So there's a number of ways in which both algorithmic decision making and the opacity of what's called lead generation is going to have a disparate impact and facilitate discriminatory intent for certain populations.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've been talking a lot about so far is it's not just the decisions that are made by nation states, as important as those are, but it's also the decisions that are made by large technology and social media firms that can have a big impact on outcomes that we care about. So how is that fact, the large impact that firms can have, shaping the way the MacArthur Foundation thinks about this area?
Well, first of all, I want to say I love working with Darren. We are a perfect cohort here of new from the inside guys, and we think alike on so many things, but I want to push back on a tiny thing. I love the fact that Darren used the words rules of the road. That is a quaint phrase that is really going by the wayside, because the rules of the road are the terms of service. And so when you think about terms of service as the new governance mechanism, think about all the people that believe that the internet is a public square. As a matter of fact, technology and social media, but not just those companies, corporations of every style and shape are actually defining the rules of the road. I mean, just imagine the fact that Facebook has a billion customers, a billion users, and the terms of service are what are actually governing how 1 billion people use that platform for their own personal use, their social purposes, the civic purposes, business purposes. Now, think about this. How many times have you clicked, I accept? Do you have any idea what you have just accepted? I mean, as a matter of fact, could you even name 5 provisions of Facebook's terms of service?
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. What you say, if a billion people have said yes, it must be okay. As a matter of fact, it's not always okay. But think about the impact of this when the very early purpose of Facebook was social interaction. It has grown to quantum times for uses. Teachers use it to assign homework. Civic organizations and individuals use it for organizing, and businesses use it to interact with their customers. And the fact is, we have now permitted, whether it was even possible to not permit, we have now permitted organizations with private interests, profit-seeking motives, to actually write the rules for privacy, security, personal control of our data, and in all those areas of those activities. In the lives of a billion people. That's sort of a mind-boggling proportion of the world's population. So think about that. That is more consequential than almost any single government. Now, keep in mind that some people have called for sort of a Magna Carta in this arena, which would be a way that users would come to agreement with Facebook and others on people's basic rights. I mean, this goes to the notion of could we ever think about privacy really as a civil right, and how does that then get embodied in documentation? So about a year ago, Tim Berners-Lee said the web was under attack from government and from corporate influence, and what was needed was new rules, sort of like a digital bill of rights in each country. Think about how what that means, each country, and what the different cultural context is in each country. Different views about privacy, different views about association and free expression. But this would be a statement of principles that would be supported by users and government officials and corporate representatives and public institutions, and it would address all the issues we've been talking about, privacy and association and free speech and responsible anonymity, things like that. Now, this is a big idea, and maybe it's a good idea, and maybe it's a bad idea, but it's an idea that I think it would be actually really hard to get from the beginning to the end. So I'm thinking that maybe a better, quicker way is to get at some of these issues, perhaps in the way I talked about earlier, which is to sort of segment the problem and begin to address it with the right people around the table. The corporations, the governments, the users, the parents, all of those, and say, how can we grapple with those issues within the context of a very concrete domain like education? And once again, I think philanthropy has a role to play here, because philanthropy has a singular focus on, within the context of competing interests, to focus on public good. So I can be optimistic at a small scale, more pessimistic at the large scale.
But don't you think, Julie, that it's, yes, you can sector by sector say, let's get education together, let's get the academy together, but there's gotta be, I mean, Tim's aspiration is consistent with his vision when he created the World Wide Web. Mm-hmm. And that is that there would be a global regime and a platform that made it possible for the globe to be connected. So we need global governance. It is true that we need, yes, it's great, we can set tables, but ultimately, nations, people must have some consensus on what the rules of the game are.
What the terms of the service of the game are?
Whatever we want to call it, whatever the laws are, whatever the policies are, because what will happen is if we again allow it to happen, it will reinforce the biases and the disparities that we currently see. So those in the global south, those in poorer countries will lose, and those of us in richer countries who already have the advantage, that those advantages will be reinforced if we don't give power to those countries, those regions that today are behind the eight ball and need to catch up. Mm-hmm. And so there's got to be some agreement that we need a focus on true, real global governance. And I know that is scary to a lot of people because it means, oh my God, are we going to have to go to the UN and create a commission or whatever? But I think we've got to deal with it at that level.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We've just heard a conversation with five experts on the topic of internet access, privacy, and security. They were Alvaro Bedoya, Executive Director at the Center on Privacy and Technology at the Georgetown Law Center, Tukunda Chinkanso, co-founder of Neolab Technology, Jeremy Malcolm, Senior Global Policy Analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Julia Stash, President of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation. The conversation was moderated by Tom Khalil of the White House Office on Science and Technology Policy. We will now turn to a conversation with a senior State Department official, Catherine Novelli. She's Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment. Undersecretary Novelli is in conversation with Ambassador Jeff Bleich, former ambassador to Australia and trustee of the World Affairs Council. The conversation was recorded before a live World Affairs Council audience. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch videos of this and other programs, to register for upcoming events, or to become a World Affairs member. And now to our conversation.
The internet is transforming the way we live and work, how we connect societies across the globe, and the role of government in protecting freedom, privacy, and security. And today I've got the privilege of sitting down with my friend, the Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and Environment at the United States State Department, Kathy Novelli, and the State Department Senior Coordinator for International Information Technology Diplomacy, which is a lot of words for the top internet chief at the State Department. So welcome, Kathy. I should say welcome back to the Bay Area before you became Undersecretary. Among many other distinguished roles that you've had, you were the head of multinational international team responsible for Apple's local government regulations and policy. So you are with Apple and clearly have so much knowledge that Secretary Kerry designated you the Senior Coordinator for International IT Diplomacy. So with all those responsibilities, what's your goal? What keeps you awake at night, and what are your targets in this new and important position?
Well, what keeps me awake at night is wanting to make sure that innovation can continue and that government doesn't inadvertently, in trying with best efforts to protect the population and to grow the economy, do something that would impede innovation. So that keeps me awake at night. In terms of what are my goals, really we're looking at three things. One is to increase access to broadband, to the internet, for the 1.5 billion people who don't have access today. And we want to do that because we know that increases in broadband, just a 10% increase in broadband penetration, is estimated to result in a 1 to 1.5% increase in per capita growth in a country. So there's a direct connection between internet penetration and economic growth, which is extremely important in the developing world. And secondly, we want to make sure that where the internet is already present, that it continues to be open, that everybody can have access to the flow of information that is on the internet, and that they can participate in the economic activity of the internet. And the third thing that we want to do is work with the private sector to develop solutions to problems that we are facing as a result of the internet, things like identity theft and other cybersecurity type of issues, which need both government and the private sector to find the right solutions.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense that what we'd want to focus on is having an accessible, open, and safe internet environment, since we're all spending so much of our time in the virtual world these days. But as you said, your first goal is to do no harm. And I think there's concern about how well the government can play and operate in this space, particularly when we look at what other governments are doing. We know that other countries like Russia and some other countries in the Middle East have been advocating for greater government oversight and control of the internet in a variety of ways. What kind of content you can transmit, whether or not it can be filtered or censored, mandating how the information is stored. Is it stored at home and it can't be stored in internationally based clouds? Whether or not they're going to put a price on internet access or different prices for different transmission speeds. All those sorts of questions. Where is the U.S. State Department on all of that?
Well, we're working really hard on all of those questions. And, you know, the last thing you were talking about on price, just think about the chilling effect that it would have if you had to be taxed every time you made a Skype call. The chilling effect it would have on the use of some of these things. And so we're working very hard to make sure that as governments develop policies, that those policies do maintain this kind of openness in terms of price. And in terms of information flow, a lot of people think about that just solely in terms of free speech and what that means, which is vitally important and something that we care deeply about because it's essential to every human being to have the right to speak freely and to be able to get access to information. It's also essential to the economy because good ideas can come from anywhere, and trying to shut off certain ideas from flowing can have a direct impact on economic activity and creativity. So it's important for all those reasons.
How do we navigate it when there's such a difference in attitudes among different countries, but we're all on the same system, we're all on the same internet? So are we looking at trying to establish a treaty or some rules of the road, Or is that too ambitious? Are we looking more at just trying to establish a few principles that we can all agree on?
Well, I think trying to establish a treaty at this point would be a very hard thing to do. And as you say, there are differences in how folks look at things, which are some of which are very legitimate differences. But I do think that coming to a consensus on some basic principles about openness, about privacy, about security at a very high level would be a very good thing. And there are some forums for those kinds of discussions that we can use. And one of them is a forum called the Internet Governance Forum, which is not really about governance, but really about bringing together all of the different stakeholders, the private sector, the NGO community, and governments to talk about what are best practices in all of these areas so that there's a menu of good decisions that can be made by governments and others as they go forward with this great endeavor that we call the Internet.
Yeah, well, you seem like a person who's uniquely suited to bridge those worlds internationally and between the public and private sector. Two questions. How do you think we're doing? And what surprised you coming out of the private sector and back into government about how things operate that you're trying to change?
Well, I think we are making progress. Mm-hmm. We have a long road to go. When I first came into the government, one of the things that we were very concerned about was that we not end up in a situation where, as was proposed by some countries, where the UN or a UN committee would start heavily regulating the Internet, which is kind of the antithesis of what the Internet's about, if you think about it. And I think that we've made a lot of progress in that regard in explaining to countries what's the benefit of an open Internet and allowing things to kind of flow and happen. We still have a ways to go. Obviously, there's some countries who remain unconvinced of that, and so we need to keep working on that. In terms of what I think we need to keep working on and can use help, I think the collaboration between the technology sector and the government needs to continue and to strengthen because there are an awful lot of really smart people, engineers and people who are creating all of these products who are busy creating those things. And then you have policymakers maybe creating their policy. And it's very important that the bridges between those two groups of people remain robustly connected so that as we think about policy, we think about it in a way that is reflecting what's really happening in technology today and where it's going to go in the future.
Mm. One of the things that struck me in your first comment was that your goal is to connect 1.5 billion people to the Internet who aren't currently connected. And it's hard to imagine how an economy operates at all or how people operate in an economy without an Internet connection. Just, you know, for example, here in the U.S., I know that 40% of our GDP, our $18 trillion GDP, is based on businesses that didn't even exist 20 years ago. And they are the result of information and communications technologies. How any country can stay relevant and can generate any prosperity without a robust broadband access and an internet literate society is hard to imagine. How do you even begin to address that goal of adding 1.5 billion people to the internet over 5 years?
Well, we are looking at pairing countries who understand what you just said, that access to the internet and keeping it open and accessible to people is a good thing. And pairing countries who agree with that with programs that are going to literally build out broadband. And that would include some that the State Department has control of, some other programs in the U.S. government that are looking to build infrastructure and adding internet into those infrastructure development programs, but also to work with other developed countries to have them be part of this solution as well. So we are going to be catalyzing all of those things into a focused type of endeavor.
Yeah, so I assume that there would be some incentives to get these mm-hmm. other countries engaged, whether it's subsidies or aid or new opportunities for trade with the United States, but some ways in which we make it in their best interest to take advantage of these resources.
Well, and I think that, you know, there is a lot of countries who understand already that it's in their best interest to take advantage of this. And I think part of it is really a matter of how do they get the resources. And as I said, I think, you know, in terms of thinking about how do we actually make this happen, for us, it's really important that if we're going to spend our energy and our financial resources on helping to be part of making this happen, we also want to make sure that it's going to happen in places that are going to preserve the good things about the internet that come forward. And so that's also going to be part of the incentive-based structure that we want to pursue.
Right, which is if we're going to give you access to this terrific tool and we're going to support it, we want to make sure that you're going to use that power for good and not evil.
Right.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the dark side of the internet, cybersecurity threats. Mm-hmm. They're becoming more diverse. They're becoming more sophisticated. They're coming from lots of different places. You have criminal networks that are engaged simply for profit. You have terrorist organizations, which are trying to undermine security through cyber threats and cyber attacks. And then you just have malicious hackers who just want, you know, who are a new age form of anarchy. They just want to bring systems down. But all of those place us, our economy, everything that we depend on, all of our critical infrastructure, at risk. So how is your efforts and the State Department's efforts, how are those addressing that set of concerns?
Well, we're working with other governments on this. We are trying to foster dialogue with them, as well as to foster more discussion between the private sector and our government, because we each have windows on this. And clearly in the private sector, their companies want to make sure that their systems are secure, and they have a lot of sophisticated folks who are working on making sure that they aren't hacked, et cetera. And they have pieces of information about attempts that are happening and things that they've been able to defeat and not defeat. Similarly, in the side of the government, we also have information about what is going on, and us trying to do this by ourselves or the private sector trying to do it by themselves, I think, isn't really going to be the solution. We really have to be working together and joining our forces, as well as working with other like-minded governments who are similarly trying to defeat these things, because it's going to take a global effort to make sure that our infrastructure and our vital financial systems are secure.
Yeah, well, the president was just out here in the Bay Area at Stanford for the Cybersecurity Summit, and he was talking about precisely what you described, much more cooperation in a variety of ways. Within the government, there's this new cyber threat center, mm-hmm. which will immediately collect information about a cyber attack within any agency and share it with the others so that they can pool their resources to stop it and also make sure that they're not vulnerable. They can see it coming. And trying to do the same thing in the private sector by getting agreements among normal competitors to say that if I'm attacked, I'm going to share that information publicly and with you, and we're going to share the solutions we've come up with, because no one is advantaged when people lose faith in the internet. You don't want to kill the category of something which is producing 40% of our GDP in just the last 20 years.
No, exactly right. And the president is very personally dedicating to making sure that we have a strong internet, that we have strong protection against cybersecurity, and that we develop very balanced policies that both protect against cybersecurity threats and security threats in general to the country, as well as maintain the privacy of our citizens, and that these are important things that have to be married to each other.
One of the areas where cyber has come up in terms of our long-term security, but also our long-term prosperity, is in our relationship with China. This is the 35th year of diplomatic ties between the United States and China. The president stressed during a recent visit to China that our two nations have an enormous stake in each other's success. We are mutually interdependent. And yet there are these concerns that if we don't get some agreement on the openness of the internet, on the security of information that passes across borders, and on the rules of the road, some basic principles, it could make it very difficult for us to take advantage of that full economic opportunity. And likewise, to the extent that we don't have some understanding of what is fair and what is not fair in the internet, that it could threaten our security and the financial viability of some of our most successful companies. So how do you see the key areas operating in cyberspace? How do you see that developing?
Well, you know, it's no secret that we don't always see eye to eye with China on every piece of policy regarding the internet. So I would start with that. But that said, I think there are some places where we actually do see importance. And building out broadband to more people is one of them. The Chinese government very much understands that being connected is important, and it's important economically for their companies. They have a number of very vibrant companies in this area. We all know about them, Alibaba and others. So I think we have a shared interest in connecting people in China and also more globally. I think we have a shared interest in protecting our infrastructure, our energy supplies, our banking systems, things like that. I think where we differ and where we have had differences is in the how to do that. And we've recently had a situation where China proposed regulations on its banking sector that had to do with what kind of equipment it was going to buy, what kind of programming that equipment had to have, and where that had to be made, that really would have, we believe, not have provided the security they wanted and would have discriminated against American companies. So we had a very robust dialogue with the Chinese from the president on down, and we were able to have that regulation withdrawn. And it is going to be recrafted, but recrafted with public participation, which we believe is the right way to make regulations, particularly in a space as complicated as this space.
Yeah. It seems a lot of countries, when they're making their rules about the internet, they're being a little short-sighted. So, for example, what people talk about is data localization, where they say, well, any important information needs to be on servers that we have here in our country. You know, once things are up in a cloud, they're in a cloud. And the issue is not where the cloud emanates from, but just how secure the cloud is. And that, you know, sometimes that may be a cloud that emanates from your country, but it may sometimes be a cloud that emanates from somewhere else. And really what people should be concerned about is security. Are there other issues where you see nations just starting to step in the wrong direction and the U.S. trying to rein them back in?
Well, that is a key one. Yeah. And I think you've put it in a very clear way that in, perhaps in the guise of security, people are looking at something that's actually balkanizing the internet, and it's causing just a lot more cost, particularly for small and medium-sized businesses who can't afford to set up a server in every single country in which they might want to operate. And as you said, there's no evidence that that is actually more secure. And so, you know, some have posited that countries want, this is somewhat cynical, but there has been some who've posited that the idea of saying that we have to have these servers in our countries so they can, their governments can have access to that information in an easier way, despite the rhetoric to the opposite. So, you know, we are working very hard, and we are trying to educate policymakers about our shared concern that things should be secure, and what is the best way to do that, and what is the best way to do that and still preserve efficiency and the ability for all businesses, but especially small and medium ones, to be able to innovate and continue to do business. And I think that is key. It's not just key in this data localization issue, as it's called, but it's also key on all of these taxes and charges that folks are discussing, because, you know, as countries want to obtain more revenue, they look at the internet as a cash cow, that if they start taxing transactions, that's going to generate a lot of revenue. But as you said, that's a very short-term way of looking at things. And I think it's important that we look at things for the long term and what is going to produce the most jobs and the most opportunity for new businesses to grow.
Yeah. Well, one other issue that people have concerns about is one you just mentioned, though, which is when information is available, to whom is it available? They're willing to put up some private information for free in order to get the benefits of free Google searches and Facebook contacts and some of these other things. But there is a growing concern about how much privacy are we giving up both to companies and to governments? And how does the State Department address striking that right balance between encouraging the growth of the internet and yet at the same time recognizing that there have to be some principles for ensuring that people's private data is not proliferating in ways that they wouldn't approve and which frighten them?
Well, there are a lot of ways to protect privacy. And in the U.S., you know, we've done it through our Federal Trade Commission and through various pieces of legislation that already exist. And there's been discussion about, you know, further, do we need more legislation in order to fill in gaps that might exist. Other countries have chosen to go farther. If you look at Europe, they have, you know, the right to be forgotten, to take yourself off or information about yourself off the internet. And I think there isn't going to be one size that's going to fit everyone. I think what is important is that the consideration is given to how to balance all of these different interests, and that there is a knowledge by those whose information is being used that that's happening. That's something that we all have to really work on. I think, you know, we all have seen the turgid, long documents that we have to agree to before we can do various things on the internet. And I don't think very many people read those. And I think we've really got to work on how do we communicate in the vernacular to people whose information is going to be shared with others so that they are truly giving their consent and not just clicking on something so they can get to whatever it is they, you know, get on with whatever they want to do.
One of those issues for the U.S. is who is us? Well, we have the older generation, like me, and then I've got my teenage kids, and our sense of privacy is very different. There are things that I would never put on the internet, which my children and their friends feel entirely comfortable sharing on Facebook for anyone who's in their circle to see. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think our generation was a little more thoughtful about separating friends from colleagues, from families, from really, really close friends, and how we shared information across that. How does the State Department try to determine what is a policy of the United States when even within the United States, there are emerging very different conceptions of privacy?
Well, there are. And I think that, as I was saying, we have laws already on the books, and we have regulatory actions and actions that are taken to enforce those laws, and consensus that on some very high-level principles that the president put out a couple of years ago. So there is at that high level some consensus, but I would say that I think this is somewhat fluid, as you said, and the comfort level that different generations of people have with information that they share is dramatic. And I have the same experience as you with your kids. And in my own mind, one of the things that I wonder is whether growing up with the internet as a reality has fundamentally changed a view of privacy, or whether the consequences of having all that information about you out there has not yet visited itself on kids who are so young.
They haven't applied for their first job yet. Yes.
Right, right. And so I think we're going to see an evolution of how does this move forward. I think the concept that everybody has a zone of privacy is something we all agree to, but how those lines are drawn, I think, is going to be different inside the U.S., and it's going to be different with different countries as well.
Now, you work closely with Secretary Kerry. He obviously he has confidence in you in selecting you. What did he say to you in terms of his goals for your leadership of the information IT space, and also your leadership of economic growth and science and technology in the State Department? What are his goals?
Well, first let me just say it's really a privilege to work with Secretary Kerry. He is somebody of great vision, as is the president. And one of the things the secretary has said from day one is that economic policy is foreign policy, and foreign policy is economic policy, and that these two things are inextricably intertwined and should not be separated. And so we are focusing on these questions of how do we ensure prosperity and development and opportunity for people throughout the world. And what can we do to present them with those opportunities? The decision about whether to take those opportunities is going to be up to those people. And part and parcel of that is this whole question of building out access to the internet, because that is another point of opportunity for people to thrive. So there's all kinds of opportunities by this, and that dovetails exactly with what Secretary Kerry's priorities have been as Secretary of State, and that is shared prosperity for all.
Well, Undersecretary, it's a terrific privilege to have you back in the Bay Area, to have your leadership in the State Department on these vital issues, and to have a chance to catch up with you today. I wish you the best of luck and Godspeed at the State Department, and I look forward to 5 years from now when there are 1.5 billion more people connected to the internet and improving their lives and improving our lives by being there.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff, and we'll look forward to working with you all as we take this forward.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this portion of the program was Catherine Novelli, Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy and the Environment. She was in conversation with Ambassador Jeff Bleich, a trustee of the World Affairs Council. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch the video of this and other programs, to register for upcoming events, or to become a World Affairs Council member. This program is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineers for this program were Good Company Productions and Jared Sport. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED. Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.